Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the U.S. Senate yesterday voted 77 to 23 to allow states to penalize businesses that participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. The bill, which also includes measures aimed at prolonging U.S. troop presence in Syria and Afghanistan, goes to the House of Representatives for consideration today. Even though the bill had broad support in the Senate, several senators, including Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Kentucky's Rand Paul, opined that the measure was likely unconstitutional and would be overturned. Then, a report published this morning by the human rights group Amnesty International concludes that the United Arab Emirates is illegally supplying advanced American weaponry to Yemeni militias and other factions there. The report describes how the UAE has become what Amnesty International calls, quote, a major conduit, unquote, for armored vehicles, mortar systems, and guns to groups accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. A parallel CNN investigation found that both the UAE and Saudi Arabia were transferring U.S. weapons to al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Yemen. And finally, it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today we focus on Trump's comments last night on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty with Russia that was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Capitol Hill. The U.S. Senate yesterday voted 77 to 23 to allow states to penalize businesses that participate in the boycott, divestment, sanctions, that's BDS movement, against Israel. The bill, which also includes measures aiming to prolong the U.S. troop presence in Syria and Afghanistan, goes to the House of Representatives for consideration today. Even though the bill had broad support in the Senate, several senators, including Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Kentucky's Rand Paul, opined that the measure was likely unconstitutional and would be overturned. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Ali, the vote here, 77 to 23, is veto-proof. Not that Donald Trump would veto it, of course. But unless there's some kind of a significant debate and turnaround in the House of Representatives, this bill, as bad as it is, would probably be signed into law. Now, my guess is it's really going to have to be decided in the courts. What do you make of this? And how do you think the federal government can enforce a bill, a law, that would curtail freedom of speech or freedom of expression?
The first thing is it is really very sad that the Senate voted 77 to 22 or 23 to pass a bill that the ACLU and many other advocates of civil rights and freedom of speech have condemned as a real direct attack on the First Amendment. However, there are some things to unpack here. Number one, I think it's notable that 22 senators, two dozen senators, actually voted against it. I think that's significant. It's a significant crack because typically pro-Israel measures in the past used to pass through the Senate, 99-0. And it's notable that all the top Democratic presidential contenders voted against it. And I think what that indicates is that this issue is really problematic in the Democratic base. In other words, you're not going to be able to be a serious primary candidate, let alone a progressive primary candidate, if you voted for this bill. So that, I think, indicates a real sea change, that we've been seeing over many years in the Democratic Party. And that leads to the question of whether this bill will even come to a vote in the House of Representatives. I'm seeing, informed speculation saying that Nancy Pelosi is not even going to bring this bill up for a vote. Not because Nancy Pelosi, is not a very, very pro-Israel politician. She is, and she has always towed the AIPAC line. But because the split that this would cause in the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. So again, what that indicates is that this issue at the base of, at the grassroots of the Democratic Party is a problem, because there is simply so much more support for Palestinian rights, and also because this is a basic issue of civil rights and freedom of speech. And we've seen a number of senators come forward and say, you know, I don't support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel, but I'll be damned if I'm going to vote for this bill because it violates the First Amendment. So there is a really broad coalition against it, which means that despite this seemingly lopsided vote in the Senate, it's, you know, there's reason to be optimistic that it may not pass the House, especially if people mobilize and make their voices heard and start calling their representatives and saying, you know, I don't want you to vote for this.
You know, I think there's something to that. I think Ali's right. There's no guarantee that this bill will even be taken up in the House of Representatives. It would be very easy for Nancy Pelosi to kill it without having to take the blame for killing it. You can send something to committee and just bury it there. You can even vote it out of committee and then send it to the Rules Committee for floor rules and kill it there.
And Ali Amunima is also right that people need to take action themselves. Don't wait for Congress to do this, that, or the other thing. Go into action, mobilize, call Congress, let people know, especially let the people in your local in your local communities, your local newspapers know that this is a fundamental assault on free speech rights. I mean, basic.
And, you know, the rationale that the supporters of these anti-BDS measures give is that, oh, well, BDS is an anti-Semitic campaign. It's singling out Israel because it's a Jewish state. Ali, how do you respond to that? Because, I mean, nothing could be further from the truth about where BDS came from historically and how it spread to become the global movement that it is today.
That's right. Now, of course, equating the state of Israel with Jews, as those kinds of arguments do, number one, is anti-Semitic, because it grants to Israel the claim to speak for Jews all over the world, and it associates all Jews with Israel. And let's remember that in this country, you know, in the United States, a large segment of the Jewish community is not on board with this, is speaking out, is mobilizing against this, and is a fundamental part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. So who is it who wants you to believe that Jews equals Israel and Israel equals Jews? It's two groups of people, Israel and Zionists on the one hand, and anti-Semites on the other, who don't want us to distinguish between Jews and Israel. And this BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is in the noblest tradition of the civil rights struggle in the United States. We celebrate Rosa Parks. We celebrate the Montgomery bus boycott. We still use boycotts in the United States when states like North Carolina or Mississippi pass laws discriminating against LGBTQ people. You even have big, you know, Fortune 500 companies who say, we won't do business in that state or we won't invest in that state. So nobody disputes that boycotting North Carolina or boycotting Mississippi is a legitimate tactic. It's only when it comes to Israel. And this also, this movement is modeled on the boycott of apartheid South Africa. So the claim that boycotting Israel is anti-Semitic is the same as saying that boycotting apartheid South Africa is anti-white. Sure, there are probably people who think that, but those aren't people we should be taking seriously. And I think it's really important to point out that, you know, in a landmark decision back in 1982, the United States Supreme Court was very clear that boycott, economic boycotts or consumer boycotts for political purposes, for the purpose of bringing about social change, had the highest level of protection as a First Amendment right, that boycott is speech. And remember, we have, you know, on the other side of that, the Citizens United decision that says money is speech, right? You can't restrict political spending because money is speech. So if money is speech, then withholding money is also speech by boycotting. If you boycott a business or boycott a country because of what it's doing, that's free speech. So, you know, no matter which way you cut it, these bills that, you know, are being pushed at the federal level, but have also been passed in about half the state, are direct attacks on that basic freedom to organize to take part in political action in order to make the world fairer and more just. And we have, just in the past year, two federal court decisions that confirm that, one in Kansas and one in, I believe it was in Arizona, to do with these, you know, state-level boycott laws, overturning them and saying exactly what I just said, that banning boycotts of Israel is a direct attack on the First Amendment and political freedom in this country. And we don't, like I said, you know, the absurdity that the U.S. Congress is trying to outlaw boycotting a foreign state while there are no laws outlawing boycotting U.S. states is really something. And on the other hand, the U.S. Congress is the biggest boycotter in the world. I mean, like something like half of the countries in the world, if not more, are under various forms of American sanctions, precisely because the U.S. believes that economic pressure, boycotts, and so on are effective in bringing about change. Of course, the U.S. is pushing boycotts and sanctions to advance imperialism and advance American control. Palestinians are using these tactics in order to win equality and freedom.
Walter, we've spoken on the show previously about a teacher in Texas who was fired from her job because she would not sign a document promising that she wouldn't boycott Israel. Now, the law says that she's perfectly welcome to boycott the United States, but she can't boycott Israel. There's already an existing law in Texas. She can't be the only person in America with standing to challenge this this law in court. Where's the ACLU in all this? Why aren't we seeing lawsuits already?
Yeah, well, no, we have. Actually, the ACLU has successfully brought lawsuits. They did bring the lawsuit in Kansas, and that was a successful challenge to the Kansas law. The ACLU has been very active in, you know, lobbying the Senate. They wrote to all the senators and making public statements about how unconstitutional these laws are. But, you know, so I have to give credit to them for that. But it's going to take more than the ACLU. I think it's really important for everyone to understand that Palestine is always the test case. It's the canary in the coal mine. It's where they test the most repressive policies because they know that, you know, mainstream politicians and mainstream media are afraid to speak out. But once you set the precedent that you can ban free speech on Israel, then, you know, it's much easier to ban free speech on, say, abortion rights or gay rights or whatever other issue, maybe on climate change. The Congress will pass a law, you know, penalizing people who advocate for, you know, a Green New Deal or something. So it becomes the test case. And that's really the danger here, is if this law stands, then there's nothing to stop the Congress from restricting. Marco Rubio, little Marco, who sponsored this particular bill, is said, you know, he's so dumb. He has no understand. I can't tell if he's pretending not to understand the Constitution or if he really doesn't understand it. But he's saying, oh, you know, these bills don't restrict free speech. You're free to boycott Israel or advocate for boycott of Israel if you want to, but you're just going to be punished by the government if you do that. I mean, he's that disingenuous and stupid that he doesn't understand that that is precisely what the First Amendment prevents. Private citizens can have whatever opinions they want. The government is not allowed to punish them for those opinions. That's what the First Amendment means. But Marco Rubio doesn't get it. And 77 members of the United States Senate don't get it either.
Let's all get involved in this. We have to speak up and speak out.
That's right. It's not too late. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And Walter Smolarek joined us here in the studio. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A report published this morning by the human rights group Amnesty International concludes that the United Arab Emirates is illegally supplying advanced American weaponry to Yemeni militias and other factions there. The report describes how the UAE has become what Amnesty International calls, quote, a major conduit, unquote, for armored vehicles, mortar systems, and guns to groups accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. A parallel CNN investigation found that both the UAE and Saudi Arabia were transferring U.S. weapons to Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Yemen. We're joined from Durham in the United Kingdom by Dr. May Darwish, an assistant professor of international relations of the Middle East in the School of Government and International Affairs at Durham University. And we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Darwish, let's start with you. Amnesty International is a very serious group. It's internationally recognized as one of the most important, if not the most important, human rights groups in the world. They're making a very serious accusation here, where the United Arab Emirates is in violation of end-user agreements with the United States and is illegally supplying weapons. What do you make of the accusation first?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that Amnesty has a very strong credibility when it comes to these kind of claims. Whether we can confirm or disprove these kind of claims, I think it's a little bit hard, but definitely we have to take these claims very seriously. And also the situation in Yemen also kind of more or less provides evidence to support these kind of claims. So in general, whether the UAE has been actually selling these arms, it is very likely that this has been happening in Yemen in the last few years. The question is to what extent or how we deal with these kind of news becomes the most important part of the question, because in a way, kind of claiming or kind of accusing the UAE and Saudi Arabia of selling arms and kind of violating human rights and kind of committing war crimes indirectly, I think it more or less conforms to what the coalition has been already doing on the ground. So I would say has been very likely that this is happening.
Tell us about these different groups in Yemen. The country is so factionalized, whether they're Sunni groups or Shia groups or even communist groups, secular groups. What are we talking about here? Who exactly is the UAE alleged to be arming?
Basically, I think that's part of the complexity of the Yemen war, that there are so many factions at play. And I wouldn't say that the doctrinal or the sectarian factor is the most important. So it's not really about Sunni Shia. It's rather about the political positions of the groups that really matters. So you have the Saudi government and you have the Yemeni government and you have the UAE. These are the three main actors, let's say the main big players in this game. But at the same time, we have Al-Qaeda group and we have other jihadi groups. And also we have Al-Houthi, who are also non-state actors operating in Yemen. And at the same time, you have also IS or the Islamic State. So on the one hand, the Saudis are more kind of supportive of the Yemeni government. And the UAE in the last couple of years have had their own independent strategy of expanding in the south of the country. And they are mainly supporting groups affiliated to the Islamic Jihad and definitely to Al-Qaeda. And part of the groups or the loyalty of these groups are kind of shifting from time to time, depending on the funds supported by these main players in the game. So it's very hard to kind of see how this is not related to funds and the selling of arms. It's all connected together. But definitely every actor has its own agenda. So the Saudis have their own agenda, the Yemeni government have their own agenda, and the UAE has their own agenda. And depending on that, they interact with these kind of local players.
And is the UAE supporting the Southern Secessionist movement as well? I mean, the modern Yemeni state, as we know it, has really only been around since the 1990s.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, this is also another important part of the kind of the question, because the UAE, part of its agenda is really playing more and controlling the southern part. And supporting these secessionist groups has been one of their main strategies all along.
The UAE, of course, is an absolute monarchy. Saudi Arabia is sort of the senior partner in that relationship and in the coalition that's waging war on Yemen. These are countries that have are regularly blasted by Amnesty International when we're talking about their report, and by, you know, like many other human rights organizations around the world. I mean, isn't there like a bit of hypocrisy involved here, right? Or maybe it's really predictability, you know, that these, you know, repressive dictatorships are doing these things.
Yeah, I do agree with you on this idea of hypocrisy. So on the one hand, the U.S. has been kind of supporting Saudi Arabia and the UAE as long as they are themselves committing the war crimes, but it doesn't matter if it kind of becomes a little bit more problematic if they start selling these arms to other groups who are also doing the same kind of crimes. So it is a little bit contradictory in that sense. So the report, I think, in that kind of like in that particular detail, they are saying that they're kind of violating the agreement between the US and the UAE regarding not selling these arms or not selling them to particular groups. But definitely, I think this is the major issue. I don't think the major issue is about the human crisis, because the humanitarian crisis has been there in Yemen since 2015, and this has been a fact on the ground. Nevertheless, the U.S. still continues to support both monarchies.
Can you tell us a little bit about, in recent history, whether this has happened? Has, in the last 20, 30, 50 years, let's say, have other countries been accused of violating these end user agreements and providing American weapons to organizations that may have committed war crimes? And if so, how were these situations resolved?
Well, to be very honest on this part, I'm not entirely sure that I know of an exact case like that. But definitely, if talking about Yemen, for example, all the U.S. arms sale to the old regime, to Ali Abdullah Saleh, transferred directly to the Houthis after the coup d'etat. So there are many of these cases where the U.S. has been supporting the regime, and after the regime is falling apart or the alliance has been kind of falling apart, the arms have been kind of used by opponents. The same thing in Libya or in Iraq, for example. So in that case, I don't really remember an exact case at the moment where there was like a violation of the agreement. But I can definitely say that this is not the first case where the arms have been going to another player rather than the intended one.
Walter, I have to tell you, I really don't remember a similar case like this either, at least not in recent memory, where an ally of the United States, as close as the United Arab Emirates, was accused of transshipping weapons or weapon systems to groups that are so diametrically opposed to American foreign policy goals. I mean, to take weapons, American weapons, and transfer them to another group is one thing. To take American weapons and transfer them to an Al-Qaeda affiliated group, or a group, even if it's not affiliated with Al-Qaeda, but that is involved or engaged in war crimes or crimes against humanity, is something that I just don't recall happening.
Yeah, it brings up this sort of big issue, which is obviously extremely embarrassing for the U.S. government. But the U.S. government's relationship with Al-Qaeda, I think, is a little bit more complicated than sort of the post 9/11 narrative of this is, you know, our ultimate enemy and, you know, forever has been, forever will be. Because, I mean, so, okay, Al-Qaeda, the translation for that is the base, right? And it's called the base because it was sort of a logistical hub that was, you know, supported by the CIA directly or indirectly to facilitate the travel of fighters from the Middle East, from elsewhere in the Middle East, to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. So, okay, it started off not that bad of a relationship. Then in the 1990s, relations soured. There was the bombings of the U.S. embassy in Tanzania carried out by Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden declares war on the U.S. 9/11 happens. Okay, relationship gets bad again. But then I think what we've seen in the past, I don't know, 5 or 10 years is that the relationship in certain cases is actually kind of warm between the U.S. and Al-Qaeda again. So there is the civil war in Libya, right? So the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which is an organization that has ties to Al-Qaeda, that was, you know, they were on the same side as the U.S. in the war against the Gaddafi government in Libya. So we have now in Yemen, right, what we're talking about right now. And then in Syria, too, I mean, I think what the U.S. policy has been in Syria, you know, the regime change push has put it sort of like objectively on the same side as the Al-Qaeda affiliate or technically former al-Qaeda affiliate, the al-Nusra Front, now HTS in Syria. So yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated.
Go ahead, May.
Yes, I completely agree with you on this point. It's definitely that there is a lot of contradiction in how the U.S. foreign policy is more or less kind of navigating this regional conflict. So on the one hand, what's happening in Libya is a little bit different of how the U.S. is approaching the Syria crisis, and definitely even radically different from what's happening in Yemen. And I think that also creates kind of many questions of why this is happening in this particular area, but not in that particular one.
You're an expert in this region. Tell me what you think Yemen is looking at in the coming years. Is there any chance that the various sides will get together and carry out or conduct legitimate peace talks? Or is Yemen doomed to just continue to break apart and to be mired in civil war?
Unfortunately, the future does not really look very bright.
I was afraid you would say that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, as long as the arms sales are continuing and the conflict is more or less driven by external and international actors rather than local player, I think this adds another layer of complexity. So now it's not just about bringing the local groups and sitting and having a peace talk to solve the civil war. It's rather a more complicated process because we have external actors like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, let alone the EU, the US, Iran, and kind of solving or bringing all of these actors to the table is not very likely, especially that with somehow the crisis and with the many history of the failure of these peace talks in the last couple of years, there is a high level of mistrust among actors, especially from the side of the Houthis towards Saudi Arabia, but also other local groups. So on the one hand, I mean, the conflict could be solved, but on the other hand, considering the history and the development of the conflict, but also the different layers that has developed over the last couple of years, it's a little bit difficult to think that the conflict will be only solved by such a peace talk.
Walter, I've been to Yemen 5 times in the last 30 years, and every time I go, it's worse than the previous time. The first time I went, there were 2 Yemens. They were negotiating to unify, and everybody was very excited. The second time, people were literally dancing in the streets because they had unified. They had created their new flag, and it was a new day, a new dawn for Yemen. The third time I went, things weren't going so well. The economy wasn't growing like they thought it would. The fourth time, they're launching Scud missiles at each other from the north and the south. And then the fifth time, it was just chaos, with Ali Abdullah Saleh basically being the mayor of Sana'a and controlling nothing else in the country. Well, it's worse yet now, with factionalization, with the country essentially breaking up into pieces, and then hostile neighbors like Saudi Arabia and, to a more distant extent, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. It just doesn't seem like there's any hope for this country at all.
I think the foreign intervention, I mean, particularly the 2015 Saudi-led but critically U.S.-supported intervention is what the key thing was that plunged Yemen into the chaos that it's in now. I mean, this is not to say anything positive or negative about the political orientation of the Houthi movement, but I mean, they were basically, you know, going to control the whole country. It was really only the intervention of that coalition that prevented the Houthis from taking Aden, the principal city in the south, and sort of the country would actually just have one government if that had happened.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Durham in the United Kingdom by Dr. May Darwish, an assistant professor in international relations of the Middle East in the School of Government and International Affairs at Durham University. And joining us here in the studio was Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from Vermont by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and learn about their group by going to their website, beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian and John.
Thanks for having me.
We had the State of the Union yesterday. Again, John Kiriakou and I are now in full agreement that the State of the Union address should be abolished.
Oh, totally.
You agree with me, John?
I do indeed.
It's just a clapping exercise.
90 minutes of my life that I'll never get back.
It's a form of punishment, and John obviously has taken this personally. But anyway, Kevin, there were a couple things that were very impactful on the issue of nuclear weapons that came up. One was the announcement by Donald Trump that the U.S. was planning to withdraw from the INF treaty. He said maybe they will, they meaning the U.S. government, will have a new treaty, including China. Or, as he put it, we will outspend and out-innovate all other countries in a new arms race. He was also talking about a new second summit with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. Again, that has a lot to do with the issue of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. We want to talk about both of those. Kevin Camps, when you listened to Donald Trump last night, especially regarding nuclear issues, what was your big takeaway?
Well, fears of a renewed full-on arms race between the United States and now Russia and now other countries, not just a arms race between two superpowers, but a multipolar arms race, because what Trump has done by withdrawing from the INF treaty is to have dismantled a half century's worth of arms control, essentially. I mean, the INF treaty was hammered out between Gorbachev and Reagan in 1987, but it was really the crown jewel of efforts that went back decades earlier. And it's not just the INF treaty. The New START treaty expires in 2021, and Trump and company have to decide to renew it. That work has to begin now. So if that one goes away too, it's like a whole new day in this regard, and we could see a full-on arms race between all these countries.
Kevin Camps is our guest, as he is every Wednesday, in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. I want to go to an audio clip from last night, Donald Trump talking about just this issue, the INF treaty. Let's listen.
Decades ago, the United States entered into a treaty with Russia in which we agreed to limit and reduce our missile capability. While we followed the agreement and the rules to the letter, Russia repeatedly violated its terms. It's been going on for many years. That is why I announced that the United States is officially withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF Treaty. Perhaps we really have no choice. Perhaps we can negotiate a different agreement, adding China and others. Or perhaps we can't, in which case we will outspend and out-innovate all others by far.
That's Donald Trump. Again, that kind of sneering tone. One thing that jumped out at me, Nicole, was, you know, here's the U.S. president announcing the end of a, as Kevin Camps has said, a signature arms limitation treaty for nuclear weapons. Again, weapons that will destroy, if used, the species and life as we know it. And that gets a big ovation in the State of the Union. It really says something about, like, the psyche here.
It did. It got a standing ovation, actually. I wanted to read about the INF treaty, a really great piece on The Nation that was just written yesterday by the head of The Nation, Katrina Vandenhoevel. She talks about the context of the INF treaty. She says, the INF treaty was the beginning of the end of the arms race and the Cold War. For the first time, the U.S. and the Soviet Union agreed not simply to limit nuclear arms, but to destroy them, some 2,700 warheads and an entire category of missiles of intermediate range. The INF treaty led directly to the reductions of strategic weaponry in the START treaty. This disarmament momentum spread to other countries. Torpedoing the INF treaty is likely to trigger the reverse process, leaving the world more at risk and more dangerous than ever. I think it's, you know, we've talked on the show about specifically what this treaty is and how it's, you know, it's it was the compromise from, you know, coming down from actually denuclearizing the world, right? It was, you know, it only applies to certain missiles, but it was an important contextual treaty that started the end of the arms race. And so, you know, reversing that really could restart an arms race.
Yeah, Kevin, same questions to you. I mean, when you listen to Trump, that big ovation, I hadn't remembered that it was a standing ovation, but of course, I mean, it's like a Congress that's addicted to war. It's not just the imperial presidency. It's an imperial Congress. They're addicted to war. They love war. Donald Trump says, we'll outspend and out-innovate everybody. You know, John, MX missiles, you can create them. You can create these new intermediate range nuclear missiles. You can't use them for anything human beings need.
No, they just sit there for decades. You know, since 9/11, and I naively thought this was going to be a temporary situation in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, but we've transitioned into a Congress that is just simply not comfortable unless we're at war and spending untold billions and billions, coming up on $1 trillion on weapons.
Annually. Yeah.
Annually. It's become the norm. And, you know, the crazy thing is Republicans and conservatives in general are always jumping up and down about their taxes being too high. Well, this is where their tax money is going. It's being wasted on offensive weapons that will likely never be used. And for what? It's a waste to make us feel better, to make us feel like we're strong and we're secure and safe. And it's all nonsensical.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Kevin. We don't want the weapons to be used because if they were, it would be a catastrophe. So if they're not used, then it's just waste spending. But altogether, it's waste spending because every dollar that goes for a new generation of nuclear weapons means those dollars are not going somewhere else.
Well, it's even worse, perhaps, than the Cold War, because, I mean, look what's happening in Pantex, Texas right now. A U.S. nuclear warhead called the W-76-1, a hydrogen bomb, is being retrofitted to become the W-76-2, which means they're taking the hydrogen bomb component out, but they're leaving the fission trigger in there. It would be about half as big as the Hiroshima blast if it were ever launched. What this is the Trump administration trying to counter alleged development by Russia of a tactical nuclear weapon, a small, usable nuclear weapon. So in that sense, we're getting closer to usability of nuclear weaponry. And then, you know, you mentioned the money. There's a study from the mid-90s called the Atomic Audit, and Dr. Arjun Makajani was one of the co-authors. And there was a figure in that book of the United States having spent somewhere around $7.5 trillion on its nuclear weapons up to that point, so 1942 to 1996. And that figure really struck me because it was a fair chunk of our national debt, right, that we've spent on nuclear weapons. And then we just saw some news from the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, where the cleanup costs for the Cold War, as Nicole mentioned earlier, are now around $377 billion. So add that to $7.5 trillion. And don't forget about what began under Obama, but Trump has really continued with gusto, this nuclear weapons modernization program that's going to cost another $1.7 trillion over the next 25, 30 years. That's a lot of money. And imagine, you know, how many Head Start programs that would pay for all time to come.
I mean, can you imagine, John, any other spending program where the government spends $7.5 trillion, and a trillion is 1,000 billions. So it's 7,000 billions, which I believe is 700,000 millions for a commodity, for an item that's not used. I mean, it was used twice, two atomic bomb blasts, which by comparison to these other bombs were small in comparison. Yeah, they incinerated Nagasaki and Hiroshima in August 1945. Hundreds of thousands of people were, you know, vaporized or killed. Hundreds of thousands more suffered radiation disease later or birth defects later. But the rest of the weapons haven't been used. Can you imagine any other single commodity where the government of the United States or any government spends $7.5 trillion for nothing?
Yeah, why have the best roads in the world, the most advanced airports in the world, the best hospitals, the strongest bridges, when you can have all these nuclear weapons that are going to sit in silos and never be used?
Hopefully.
And in the meanwhile, there's all of this cleanup that has to be done.
That's right.
In that same report Kevin was talking about, this is in Popular Mechanics magazine, they're adding up a lot of the cleanup that has had to be done over the past few decades. The Department of Energy is responsible for this cleanup, for creating these nuclear, the cleanup for these sites that created these nuclear weapons. And it includes storing and treating about 90 million gallons of radioactive and hazardous waste that's located in nearly 240 large underground tanks at three sites across the country. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of waste to be dealing with. But there's also, dealing with cleaning groundwater and soil, disposing of spent nuclear fuel. There's 2,400 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel, and that stuff is highly, highly toxic. I mean, the list goes on. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's just countless things to be dealt with after what happened in the Cold War, and we could be starting this again, even if we're not starting this again. We've talked on the show a lot about all of the cleanup from nuclear power as well.
Yeah, those are excellent points. Kevin, I want to talk about two things. One, he said it, we talked about the spending part of it. The other point that he made is that we're going to out-innovate everybody. Now, let's just think about innovation here. Innovation means research and development, right? You put the best scientists, give them enormous resources, you put them together, you pool the resources, you have lots of engineering capacity and engineers at work. So you're innovating. Now, there's all kinds of talk about how military technologies then sort of morph into civilian industry. And we make a big deal out of the fact that it was the Pentagon that started the internet. So there's this kind of collateral benefit from military spending. But I think it's largely overdrawn. And I can remember Professor Seymour Melman's books on militarism. And he makes the point that the vast suck of research and development talent and money into weapons production is actually profoundly damaging to civilian economy because it's a drain. And I'm just taking that point, Kevin, and thinking about nuclear innovations or nuclear weapons innovations. How much of this is actually applicable later to civilian technology?
Well, it seems such a sick conversation to have. I mean, as I mentioned, it may be worse now than the Cold War. Look at what Putin has threatened in the form of a doomsday machine, so to call it, of a 100 megaton nuclear torpedo that could be fired after Russia is already turned to ash, and the consequence would be literally a radioactive tsunami hitting a place like New York City. So this is the innovation we're talking about. These are planet-destroying weapon systems. And, there's all this talk about mutually assured destruction will guarantee that they'll never be used. We know better than that now. We know that the Cuban Missile Crisis came closer to going nuclear than had been known for decades. And we know that because of Soviet military commanders on a submarine in the Cuban Missile Crisis, in a Moscow missile base, in a separate incident, only because of tremendous personal courage on the part of Soviet military commanders, defying orders, essentially, were missiles not launched, torpedoes not launched, that would have sparked an all-out nuclear war. In the 1960s and the 1980s, we've had some very close calls in the past. And now we're talking about doing it all over again, only with more gunslingers in the Wild West saloon, in the form of other countries with nuclear weapons and more usable nuclear weapons. So, yeah, we have a choice between, a future or nuclear Armageddon, and we keep flirting with the latter.
Kevin, those are really important points, and it's always important to hear from the past and listen to the stories of how close we've gotten in the past. Even if mutually assured destruction were a concept that has been, that there's evidence would work, even if that's true, we already have tons of huge nuclear weapons that can destroy countries, continents. I mean, that's just as good for mutually assured destruction as planet destroying. Like, what kind of innovation is actually going to be helpful for diplomacy, for getting peace on this planet? None of these things are going to be helpful. This is not useful innovation. Whereas we do need innovation in how we design our cities, how we get people into housing. We do need innovation for getting the food deserts in our country that many poor communities have no access to food. We do need that kind of innovation. Yeah. There are lots of forms of innovation we could use those billions and trillions of dollars for.
Yeah, and how we get to work instead of driving in cars that are clogging the highways and polluting the skies and leading to global warming. All that innovation is needed. Those are excellent points. Go ahead, Kevin.
There's been such tremendous work done on these very issues for a long time. So like when the Soviet Union fell, you know, there was some wisdom on Capitol Hill that we had better be involved in making sure that those Soviet nuclear weaponeers have something to do and have an income so that they don't go to other countries that are willing to pay for them to come there and help them build nuclear weapons. So those are the kind of innovations, the just transitions away from a nuclear war economy, a nuclear weapons economy, into, let's say, renewable energy economy. You know, it's kind of ironic, but I took a tour of Los Alamos National Laboratory in 2009, and what was funny about it was that they told us all the good stuff they were doing, and they were doing some good stuff about auto efficiency upgrades, renewable energy research. They didn't mention one peep about nuclear weapons, and then and now they're still very involved in nuclear weapons advancement and production. So they're kind of shy about that work. They don't really want us to know about it, you know, as an anti-nuclear group takes a tour of the facility. But, you know, we should end the nuclear weapons work and we should transition places like Los Alamos into doing important good work. And climate was mentioned. We'd better get cracking on that one or we're going to pay a very high price. We already are.
We already are. And, you know, we've talked on this show and there are many climate scientists, many energy-based scientists, even energy scientists at the DOE, energy researchers at the DOE, the Department of Energy, who are working and I'm sure could use more support, more staff, more money on figuring out how do we make this country 100% renewables driven? How do we innovate and find a grid, get a grid connected where we can store energy that's created when it's sunny out or when it's windy out? How do we have these ideas. We have so much innovation already in figuring out these, how to harness these renewable energies. We just need more time, more money, more people working on those instead of getting a planet destroying missile.
That was the voice of Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. We're also joined in this segment called Beyond Nuclear by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can go to their website, beyondnuclear.org, find out about the group, read their writing, see their analysis, and most importantly, get involved if you agree with them. Kevin, I want to, before we go on to another issue, and I want to transition to the issue of the upcoming Trump-Kim Jong-un summit and what it means for the prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula and also what it might mean for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Before we do that, I want to stay on the INF Treaty just with one more little tack here, and that is Trump's argument is that the Russians are in violation of the INF, that they have been in violation and that the U.S. has lived up to the treaty to the letter, as he put it. I want to talk about, is Russia in violation? Are both countries in violation? What is the character of the violation? And then I want to circle back to the issue that you mentioned in terms of the announcement by the Russians of new nuclear weapons systems, including what's popularly characterized as by them as the doomsday weapon. But let's start first with the question of compliance.
Well, beginning several years ago under the Obama administration and continuing now under the Trump administration, there have been allegations by the U.S. government that Russia has violated the INF treaty by developing a land-based fireable missile, nuclear capable, that can travel between 300 miles and 3,300 miles in distance. And that would be a stark, blatant violation of the terms of the treaty. But the Russian government, for its part, has also accused the U.S. of violations of the treaty. And so instead of scrapping the treaty, one would think that the two sides should sit down and resolve these issues. And not only that, but invite other countries into the treaty, like China, so that the treaty is strengthened and enforced, not done away with, so that we're in this Wild West scenario where anything goes at that point. And granted, there were limits to the value of the treaty. I mean, sea-based and air-based missiles were not included, so that could be another expansion of the treaty. It's just a very upside-down way of looking at it, that we just get rid of all these treaties because they're not perfect. How about we try to perfect them instead of scrapping them?
It's all about desire and will, really, isn't it? Because let's say the Russians are in non-compliance, or let's say the Americans are in non-compliance. If both sides recognizing that there could be breaches of a treaty, and that's not unusual in weapons agreements or in military agreements of all types, if there was a desire to continue with an arms control regime, then you say, okay, we are going to give you an opportunity to resolve the noncompliance and let's talk it through. And both sides could say that. The fact that Trump has declared unilaterally, and that's what this declaration is, a unilateral withdrawal, is an indication by the Trump administration, and we signal, and I think this was signaled under Obama too, that the U.S. military actually no longer wants to be part of the treaty. I mean, it's really about desire and will, no?
I think, I mean, it was mentioned that there was a standing ovation when Trump talked about withdrawing from the INF treaty. I'd have to watch the video and see if the camera angle showed it, but there were many moments last night when the Democrats didn't join their Republican friends and colleagues, and I think this might have been one of them. I think there's concern on the Democratic side about this disassembly of arms control agreements going back, you know, a half century at this point. There's certainly action on the Democratic side to try to prevent first use of nuclear weaponry by any U.S. president without congressional authorization. So I think there is a difference between the two, but unfortunately, there are similarities between the two. As we've mentioned, the Obama administration began the nuclear modernization program that now Trump is expanding, essentially.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Russian response to the announcement. On February 5th, Vladimir Putin said, quote, "Our response will be symmetrical. If our American partners suspend their participation in the INF treaty, so will we. And if they start working on new weapons, so will we." Not a big surprise there. Let's talk about the Russian, what the Russians called, I think, the doomsday weapon that they have. What's the military point of that? Obviously, they went out of their way to make it very public. They showed a video. Putin did a video of it. What's from a military calculation point of view, why have the Russians developed this weapon from your point of view?
Well, the U.S. nuclear weapons and conventional weapons are so formidable that even Russia is fearful of a decapitation strike where Russian leadership is simply taken out before they can even launch a retaliatory strike. And so a doomsday machine, and it harkens back to Dr. Strangelove in the early 1960s, but unfortunately this is nonfiction, is a dead hand technology that will simply detect radioactivity, will detect explosions in the Russian homeland, and will respond by firing, in this case, a 100 megaton nuclear torpedo hidden somewhere in the ocean, perhaps on board a submarine, that would target a place like New York City. And the 100 megaton blast would create a radioactive tsunami wave that would not only flood the city and drown perhaps millions of people, but would then render the city either destroyed from the flood, but certainly contaminated so badly with radioactivity that it would be uninhabitable. So it's a way for someone who is outmatched by missile technology to simply retaliate even after being destroyed.
John, you've seen Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, yeah.
I think Walter Smolarek, our Sputnik News producer, too young to have seen it at the time, would only be born like 30 years after it came out in 1964. He's now watched it.
I'll work on it. Sorry.
You haven't seen it? Well, you have an assignment tonight.
Okay.
It's fun. You'll enjoy it. But what that movie talks about, and it's Stanley Kubrick is the director, it's a satire on the mentality of the nuclear arms race in the 1960s. And the U.S. launches a nuclear weapons attack with this rogue commander taking a B-52, and he's all happy about it because he knows if we don't do this now and get it over with, the Russians are going to take over America. And there's all kinds of other parts. People should really, really watch the movie.
It does sound kind of fun.
But part of it is that Peter Sellers, who's playing multiple roles in the movie, one of them is the president of the United States. He learns sort of at the last minute when he's trying to tell the Russians, hey, can you stop this rogue B-52 nuclear attack from an American rogue commander? Can you do something about it? And then he learns that the Russians have something called a doomsday machine. And once the line has been crossed, they can't pull it back. And so the world will come to an end. And that's how the movie comes to an end. It seems like ridiculous satire, but in fact, the Russians actually did have a doomsday machine weapon then. The Russians are now saying, if you are developing the capacity to wipe us out with first strike weapons, we have what Kevin Camps is saying is a dead hand, meaning if even if we're dead, there will be a triggering device that will come at you such that it will destroy you. And so don't believe that you can actually outpace us with first strike weaponry or defense missile shields. We've entered into a new realm of ridiculous but dangerous war planning and contingency planning, and it's real, and money is being spent on it. And again, unlike the Cold War, where there was a managed equilibrium, a managed rivalry, where there were treaties, now the American government is, under Trump and earlier under Obama, getting rid of those treaties that created the equilibrium that made nuclear weapons perhaps unlikely.
And the word,
or the use of them.
The proper word there is equilibrium. We've been thrown off now with our withdrawal from these important treaties, and there doesn't seem to be any indication, at least publicly, that the State Department and the Defense Department are in the process of renegotiating these treaties or trying to negotiate new treaties. And so the equilibrium is off. Now, other countries, when they see this kind of thing, have to conclude that they might as well do whatever they want to do and develop new weapons and build more weapons, because the United States is doing that. And in the worst scenario situation, they're going to have to be able to defend themselves.
Kevin Kemps, we have 1 minute left. We were going to talk about the Korean issue, but we'll come back to that next week. I wanted to also ask you that Trump was boasting last night that he forced our, quote, allies, meaning the NATO countries, to spend $100 billion more on what's called defense, another $100 billion on weapons. Again, this is the kind of gloating, bragging, boasting about things that the Europeans certainly don't need and most Europeans don't want.
Yeah, to be fair to the Obama administration, I mean, they did hammer out the New START treaty with Russia. They also hammered out an agreement with Iran, and that's all being torn apart before our eyes by Trump. But, you know, even in terms of NATO, you know, the Europeans have lived through two world wars in the last century. Now they're on the front lines yet again of a potential nuclear Armageddon. We really need to get past this war stuff, especially with nuclear weaponry, or, you know, the worst could happen.
Yeah, it's completely gratuitous. It's completely unnecessary. Some people are making lots and lots of money. When you spend $7.5 trillion on nuclear weapons, somebody's getting those contracts. Anyway, we were joined from Vermont by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the Organization Beyond Nuclear. We can't overstate to our audience how important it is for you, if you care about these issues, if you agree with what's being said here, to go to the website of Beyond Nuclear. It's beyondnuclear.org, and learn about how you can get involved. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Russell.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.